Hello, everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food. It's June 3rd, 2014. A beautiful, beautiful day here in New York City. Finally. Why don't these things last forever? If it was beautiful outside every day, would we appreciate it? I would. I really would. It was so good today. And it continues to be good, and I hope it's good wherever you are. And whenever you are listening, because I know some of you listen later than live, right? Let's move forward, and we've got a very interesting program today. I want to bring on my first guest, Anthony Nocella. He earned his PhD from Syracuse University Maxwell School. He's a professor and an intersectional scholar, community organizer who has published more than 50 scholarly articles or book chapters. He's the editor of Peace Studies Journal, senior fellow with the Dispute Resolution Institute at Hamline Law School, and co-founded and is director of the Institute for Critical Animal Studies. He's published more than 20 books, including Earth, Animal, and Disability Liberation, The Rise of the Eco-Ability Movement, Global Industrial Complex, Systems of Domination, Defining Critical Animal Studies, an Intersectional Social Justice Approach to Liberation, and The End of Prisons, Reflection from the Decarceration Movement. 2009, he co-founded with others, including four youth incarcerated in New York City, Save the Kids, a leading national grassroots organization working to dismantle the school-to-prison pipeline and the end of the incarceration of youth. His areas of interest include environmental studies, disability studies, justice studies, and peace and conflict studies. And if this isn't amazing and you haven't heard enough, go to his website, anthonynocella.org. Welcome to It's All About Food, Anthony.
Hi, thank you for having me, and it's a pleasure being here. And Anna, you were just noting the weather. It is great here in the Twin Cities as well. So, and I was, you know, I took a little walk today, you know, to a meeting rather than, you know, taking the public transit and stuff. So that was really fun.
You're in the Twin Cities.
Yes, I am. So we have a lot of lakes and the big river, you know, and a lot of universities and a lot of wonderful parks as well. So it is it's a smaller city, or two cities, but it's really nice out here. And there's a lot of progressive conversations and actions and organizing going on throughout different movements, as well as within the animal advocacy and vegan communities as well. And so that's, you know, really nice to see. And, you know, the Twin Cities has a long history of animal advocacy, and people don't know their U.S. animal advocacy history. The Twin Cities has one of the oldest grassroots movements, and it has the oldest, if you know, I hear from a number of people, the oldest grassroots active organization going on right now, which is the Animal Rights Coalition, which does some really great work. And there's, you know, a number of other organizations as well, Compassionate Action for Animals, and some other local animal rights groups within colleges and high schools. So there's a lot going on.
I've been there a few times. Back in the day when I was executive director of Earth Save International, we had a Twin Cities chapter. And
wonderful.
It was really good to go there, and a lovely place. And you're right, a lot going on. And there were some companies, like, isn't Seventh Generation from that area?
When it comes to companies, I do not know.
Yeah, okay.
You'd be an expert on that, maybe. So
okay, anyway.
I can't tell you. But I do know that Target and Best Buy and 3M, which are not the most vegan-friendly companies, are there. So, and I know that University of Minnesota does animal research, and so
yeah.
I know all the bad things.
There's the good and the bad.
Exactly.
Right, but you've got a lot of good food, too. I ate well when I was there.
True. Yeah.
All right, now let's get to talk about you. You are pretty amazing. You've written so many books. You're doing such incredible work. So where do we begin? Can we talk a little bit about the Institute for Critical Animal Studies? What is it? What do you do? What are you doing right now? And why are you doing it?
Exactly. So it's a fully volunteer organization, and it started in 2001 as titled the Center for Animal Liberation Affairs, Kayla. Then in 2006 to 2007, we changed the name and developed the field of critical animal studies. And if anybody knows anything about oppression, they know that if you provide space, which is the actual conversating about a topic, so if we talk about animal advocacy and we're not allowed to speak about animal advocacy, let's say in the United States, then we don't have space. And then also place is actually the physical organizing. So when we put on events and conferences and rallies and teach-ins and film screenings, that's the place. So critical animal studies provide space and place for animal advocacy and intersectional animal advocacy to take place within higher education. And people say, oh, that's, you know, what's so important about that? Well, with almost every single conference that we do, and this is kind of scares people off, but you shouldn't. You know, if you want to create social change, you will be, you know, you will threaten people because you're threatening them with new ideas, kind of like the world is round or, you know, a variety of other issues.
Well, animal activists are considered terrorists today in some
exactly
with our government.
And,
yeah.
And so, you know, with the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act and so almost at every single conference that we did since 2001, we've had the presence of law enforcement or security heightened just to speak about these issues. So
wow.
When people say, no, this doesn't exist, you know, like, I've gone to, you know, political science association conferences, sociology, social science, education, et cetera, all throughout the whole country, and, you know, the continent on, different academic fields. And I've never seen, and it would be kind of ridiculous to even assume that there would be police presence or heightened security around research labs on particular campuses, right?
Yeah.
At Vassar, when we had the Students for Critical Animal Studies, the first one take place, Vassar College asked the students to pay for the security for the research labs. And they said, what? We have to pay for your security because you all are fearful of us. And, and that was, you know, again, the case at many other, you know, institutions that we've done these conferences. And, you know, to date, nothing, you know, nothing bad has ever happened, meaning illegal or direct action or even protesting, right? Because we understand that when we're in a space of conversation, you can't do too much or, you know, you get overwhelmed and you get exhausted and, we do these conferences maybe a day long or 2 days long. So we don't want to throw too many things, like, in the mix. And when we do, you know, rallies or something, they're typically off campus, down the street or something of that sort. And they're not targeting the actual university. You know, and we're talking about candlelight vigils because of non-human animals being researched on and vivisection occurring. So, you know, again, just having these conversations, having that space and place and arguing for that is threatening the largest, besides sports, the largest funding opportunities in higher education. And we know that higher education is becoming corporatized. So they're very much interested in, you know, the largest amount of profit, right? And
yep.
The administrators are now making, you know, up to the millions, and while the professors, if they are even professors at many universities, and most of them are adjuncts, right?
That's right. Keeping the cost down. Yep. Pay them as little as you can.
Yeah. So there's this, you know, this development of this, like, corporate university mentality, and the two largest funders besides sports is the hard sciences, right, and then the other, besides donors and trustees and things, which I'm not even taking into consideration, but and tuition, of course, but is also agriculture. So look at, for example, Texas A&M or Florida A&M, a variety of agriculture-based institutions that would never see the light of day of critical animal studies on their campus because the actual, you know, as Foucault says, knowledge is power.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we're trying to develop within the Institute for Critical Studies, spaces and places for people to challenge the dominant, you know, quote, paradigm that exists. And if we do that, which, you know, this is no top secret, if we do that, we're going to change how the future exists. For example, if we don't have anybody in higher education teaching vivisection, we will not have any vivisection companies like Huntington Life Science in the future, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's not protesting Huntington Life Science, which we should do, that will end all vivisection. It's actually protesting universities and colleges. So we have to figure out who's educating these people about agriculture and, you know, cutting a hole into cows to feed them so they can just be in a cage their whole life rather than grazing the mass factory farming that occurs. So that's what the Institute for Critical Studies kind of has done and is doing, and we do it, you know, in a somewhat, I believe, effective way. And we are now global in Australia, South America, Africa, Europe, and a variety of Middle East and in Asia. And we have annual conferences in all these regions and now a Student for Critical Animal Studies conference. And we're pretty excited about, you know, the development of all these volunteers, you know, students, graduate students and faculty that are, you know, caring about this issue and seeing the strategic, while there is so many wonderful activist groups that are protesting McDonald's and KFC and, you know, Procter & Gamble, we also need to shift the idea of what education that these undergraduates and graduates are getting and they're forced to get in their core courses, right? You have to take a biology. You have to do dissection. Well, we want to transform that, and that's kind of what ICAST spends most of our time doing, is having those conversations and asking those very difficult questions.
Wow, you can take a breath now. I'm taking a breath just listening. I held my breath the whole time. This is something I never even thought about, and it's so important to have a space and a place to have these conversations. It seems like so many of the right things are not moving forward because we don't have control anymore. We've given up so much control in our culture, and I certainly hope we can get it back. But I was just talking about this earlier with a friend of mine about how we've gotten to this place of convenience and specialization, and we've allowed people, different industries, to do very specific things, and one of them is to make our food. And we've given up the control of making our food. We don't know how to prepare it. We don't know how to cook it. We don't know how to grow it. And as a result, it's tampered in ways that many of us wouldn't support. But we've lost control, and we've lost control in so many different arenas, I think, from specialization and for convenience, and we really need to get it back. And definitely we've lost control in the education arena. So this is good news, that there's a space where people can speak.
Yes, I think that, you know, and one of the things that Critical Animal Studies does also is really values activism and community organizing from an intersectional approach. So all of our programs and websites and Journal for Critical Animal Studies. And yesterday we just developed another project, the Journal for Critical Animal Studies in German. So we'll be publishing articles and essays from you know, the Journal for Critical Animal Studies, as well as original articles in German, to develop that it's not just a U.S.-centric, European, English-based movement. And there's a lot of people that are trying to do that. We just assume that the world knows what about animal rights and, you know, has read, for example, Tom Regan. But not everybody has, because not all the books are accessible. Sending a book from the U.S. to Brazil costs, you know, $150, mm-hmm. just one book. So we have to understand that the complexities of capitalism and trade in developing a movement, that some of these books need to be open access, which our journal is, so people can download it as a PDF anywhere and it's free. So that's, you know, some conversations that we have, we talk about issues of disability, which is a very important issue, you know, in my life, and how animals and disability and the conversations within our movement, you know, are sometimes ableist. We use, you know, language like idiot or crazy or freak or moron to talk about vivisectors or each other sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to, you know, if we want to broaden this movement, which we always do, and you're about to have another wonderful, you know, interview with somebody with the Food Empowerment Project, and they talk, you know, a lot about class and race issues, and so does, you know, the Institute for Critical Studies talking about, you know, how does education, how does access, you know, address being vegan. And is vegan, you know, what does vegan look like to you might not be what vegan looks like to me, a packaged, processed tofu burger that was, you know, the soy came from Brazil, you know, clear-cutted Brazil, displaced people, you know, and these are the conversations that we have is, complicating what it means to be an animal advocate and what it means from an intersectional perspective, you know, and what it means to be vegan, right? And that it, how does being vegan, aid or not, you know, aid in eliminating economic oppression and support economic justice, on the other hand. And, you know, those are the daily conversations that we have on Facebook and our blogs and our events. So if people are, you know, listening in, those are the, you know, people are like, why would I want to get involved in critical animal studies? I'm not a professor. But these are the, you know, a lot of the people that come to our conferences aren't professors, but they're activist community organizers wanting to get a breath of fresh air, you know, and not speak just about animals, but about, you know, a lot of other, you know, social justice issues.
Well, you've probably heard this, but people often think that those of us who care about animals and are concerned about animal exploitation don't care about people.
Yes, and sad to say, there is, you know, some work damage control, one might say, to address this issue, right? Peter Singer, who's wrote a pivotal book, and as a person that does eco-ability, which is kind of the connection between disability and animals, he said, you know, and he's protested almost everywhere he goes from the disability community because he says, from a utilitarian, if we can test on an infant or a baby, person with disabilities, and that testing on that baby with disabilities will help the larger community, then we should.
Mm-hmm.
From a utilitarian perspective. And it's like, oh, did you really have to say that, Peter? You have such a good point when it comes to animals. And then you had to open your mouth, you know, and speak about this issue. And we do this, you know, repetitively around issues of race and gender, you know, and transgendered issues and sexuality as well. And so, yes, Peter has some great issue, you know, conversations and points about animal advocacy, but he really is. So we have to go, there are people, you know, within the movement that really don't like people. And I can understand that sentiment because they themselves have been hurt, or they see slaughterhouses and they said, is there any humanity? And I think, you know, after being in the movement for about 20 years and starting when I was, you know, 16 and so, and being vegan, you know, a little after that, you know, I really do see, you know, that, I don't know if I'm going to win a campaign, which I do community organizing on a daily basis around youth justice and school-to-prison pipeline and prison abolition work as well. But I don't know if I'm going to win, but it's what's right, and I have hope in people. And I think that's what we have to, you know, develop again within our movement is hope. And then that not everybody knows the right answer, that I wasn't, you know, taught to be a vegan. I wasn't taught to be an anti-racist. I wasn't, you know, taught at a very, very young age to, know about disabilities or know about issues of sexism, right? And I think within our movement, we're very critical of ourselves, but we still have to know that we're teaching ourselves as well, that we're, you know, developing, as a group, if that makes sense. And,
that's a very important concept and very, very hard to do all the time because there's so many things out there that are just so horrific, and we ask ourselves, how could anyone who feels do these things? And it's just a constant reminder that many of us, myself included, I wasn't always vegan, although I have been for most of my life, but you know, at one point I wasn't, and to have that hope and that belief that there's good in all of us, that takes a lot.
Yeah, because we get beat down by one another, you know, and, mm-hmm. you know, myself included. You know, I do, you know, the beating sometimes and, you know, and not on purpose, but that's not the point. And we have to really understand that we have to learn how to communicate with each other. And I think that's why I write a lot on transformative justice and healing and taking accountability. And, you know, we do come from, you know, different perspectives. You know, myself with disabilities and other people in the movement that have disabilities, we have to, you know, take some time to work on ourselves rather than just always working on the issue. Because we are being beaten down by the systems that be. The Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, which I have a book coming out called The Terrorization of Dissent, and it has, you know, a lot of people in the movement talking about the ATA from a legal perspective, a philosophy, a sociological activist perspective, and that should be out by Lantern Books, you know, in a few months.
Oh, great.
So that should be really exciting. Hopefully that will be a text that will really, you know, beat down the ATA. And, you know, so you have all these laws that are ridiculous. I mean, if that law was really put into effect, you know, and I don't think a lot of people have read that whole law, but it is so damaging. It's constitutionally, against the law. It doesn't allow the First Amendment whatsoever towards animal advocates, right? So if you're basically in simple terms, if you're an effective animal advocate toward a corporation, you're a terrorist, right? And so if you make any economic hardships towards any corporation, you know, they can find you as a terrorist under the ATA. And so what you have to protest these companies and still pay them to keep, you know, growing and make sure that their bottom line doesn't, you know, decrease, if that makes sense.
It's crazy. But that's what comes out of fear. Fear and misunderstanding. And I know that law in particular came out of, you know, a few unfortunate acts and people were afraid. And the act is clearly much more extreme than it should be, if it should be there at all. But I'm curious about these conferences that you have and the people that are wary of what you're doing. Have you had some people attend that were turned around and realized you had some valuable information?
For sure. We typically get a lot of the deans and the chairs, and like I am a professor as well, and many of the people that present at these conferences are professors and chairs, and you know, and so yes, we get a lot of humanistic people that don't care about, you know, or not aware. I wouldn't say don't care. It's a, you know, I think, but are not aware of like veganism or animal advocacy, or they're just turned off because of, you know, some acts that they've seen by, you know, activists. And so we influence students. We always have our conferences very affordable at colleges because we want to get the students at these colleges to come for free to listen and to learn and to challenge and to have that dialogue about animal advocacy because they're not getting into the classes. We also invite faculty and professors and deans and chancellors to do welcomings and do presentations as well. So we don't have our conferences at the Sheraton or the Holiday Inn on purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And not to say that, you know, doing a conference at that, we just can't afford it.
Yep.
We get all of our spaces for free. But we also strategically want to be where the people are. So, you know, we are influencing, you know, people about veganism and things. And, you know, there's some times that some people come in from Australia to a conference and they say, wow, we never, you know, thought about this or this before. And then they go back to their country and they, you know, help develop new ideas and things. So the conferences are really, you know, a great place to build friendships as well as networks and, you know, challenge each other on ideas and learn new ideas.
Okay, we just have a few minutes, and I wanted to talk about your Save the Kids project. It's a human animals now we're talking about.
Yes, I just had, I've been doing that for a long time. I do a lot of prison work, and I really try to address the youth justice, racial justice, and animal, you know, animal advocacy, and try to interconnect the struggles together. And so with Save the Kids, named by four youth that were incarcerated in New York, I trying to challenge that the school-to-prison pipeline, where is that youth are being pushed out of the system of schools, specifically LGBT kids, kids with disabilities, youth of color, and youth that are economically disadvantaged into the streets, and then, of course, into the hands of police many of the times. And specifically when we do, you know, last week or a week and a half ago, we did the National Week of Action Against Incarcerating Youth, and we had about 100 events, 30 cities, and maybe 500 plus sponsors, and it was all, of course, you know, volunteer based. And we talk, you know, some of these conversations that we have on a daily basis with youth are around food justice, right? So I think, you know, we need to understand that not everyone has a Whole Foods or a Trader Joe's around the corner.
Right.
Some people don't have grocery stores around the corner, and so when we do workshops, we talk about food justice, and we talk about the, and one thing that I'm learning as well from other people that, you know, people of color that do food justice work, is the whole concept of a food desert, and that a food desert is a problematic corporate term to say that there's nothing here, so we can create a Trader Joe's or a Whole Foods or a co-op, not to say that there is something beautiful here, and that what we have here is a park or a space that can be turned into and be owned by the local people. So this idea of food justice is really developing, and it's becoming, you know, very complicated. And it's really nice because there is spaces to talk about veganism in an issue around racial justice and economic justice, and you know, I talk to, you know, people all over the country, and I do tours and stuff. And when I do, I talk to them about youth justice and food justice. I say, well, and this is, you know, this is kind of where I'll wrap up, is I do this, I do workshops in detention centers, and the whole, you know, youth justice, like an 8-hour youth justice workshop, and it's really exciting, and we do all these things. And at the very end, the kids get to choose the food that they want.
Hmm.
And they can choose anything they want, right? And because they get to have some freedom being locked up. Some of them are going to go be locked up for the rest of their lives. Some of them are going to do 10 years or a year. So if I can give them that opportunity of freedom, right, so then what do? I have the choice to be the very strict vegan and say, you only are going to have tofu pizza, right, which they probably won't eat.
Mm-hmm.
Or do I say, choose what you want, and then later, when I'm eating my salad, right, they get to say, why are you eating salad? And then I order pizza and pepperoni for them, right?
Right.
And it's a very difficult conversation, but it's a conversation to talk about injustices and oppression. But while on the outside, you know, when I do, you know, when we do, you know, picnics and gatherings in the community at, like, local parks, which we do, you know, a few times a month, of course, most of the food there and all the food that I bring is vegan. Why? Because the youth that come from the outside are there on their own voluntary will, and they don't have to eat this because they can go home 10 seconds later and eat whatever they want. So,
right. It's very compassionate of you and clever at the same time.
So, and I do get that. You know, just to kind of note is that it's a complicated issue that I get a lot of pushback on within this particular animal advocacy movement.
Yes.
If that makes sense, and I'm sure you understand.
I do. Yeah. Well, Anthony, we could talk about this all day.
Yeah.
But I just want to point my listeners to your website. So there's criticalanimalstudies.org, your personal website, anthonynocella.org. And I've got to start reading some of your books. Look forward to the new one coming out.
keep up the great project. And, of course, you're having a wonderful next interview with a great person with Food yes. Empowerment Network.
Yes, thank you. Okay, take care, Anthony.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Okay, before we take a quick break, I just wanted to mention my nonprofit, responsibilityandliving.org. We just put up a new trailer for our documentary that's coming out in a week, The Lone Vegan, Preaching to the Fire. So if you can go to the website, it's just 40 seconds and you can watch it. I hope you will, and let me know what you think. Okay, let's take a quick break. Hello, everybody. We're back, and I'm Karen Hartglass. This is June 3rd, 2014, another It's All About Food program. Now let's get right to the next part with Mark Hawthorne, the author of Bleeding Hearts, The Hidden World of Animal Suffering. He's actually the author of two books. The other book is Striking at the Roots, A Practical Guide to Animal Activism. And we're going to jump right in and talk about Bleeding Hearts. Welcome to It's All About Food, Mark. Thanks for joining me.
Well, thank you, Karen. It's going to be challenging following somebody like Anthony.
No. I'm glad. I was so glad to hear to talk with him, and then I'm glad I set it up this way. I had no idea what it was going to be like, but I just finished reading your book, Bleeding Hearts, and I have to spell this B-L-E-A-T like Tom, I-N-G. I'm sure the pun is intended. But it's important, Bleeding Hearts, and I'm just emotionally exhausted after reading your book. And so when I was talking to Anthony, I was very inspired and glad to hear that there are safe spaces where people can be talking about this and then making change, because we need a lot of change. But first, we need to be educated, and that's what this book is all about.
Right, exactly.
How did you write it? I spent, you know, a brief time reading the 499 pages, but how do you write a book like this?
Very carefully. you know, after I had written Striking at the Roots, and it came out in 2007 and early 2008, I started getting emails from activists all over the world telling me about the various animal abuses that they were combating in their countries and how they were using Striking at the Roots to help them. And it really inspired me, and it showed me that not only is animal activism very much alive and well all over the world, but there are forms of animal exploitation that the mainstream media doesn't cover, mm-hmm. or if it covers it, it's very minimal.
Yeah.
And so right after Striking at the Roots came out in 2008, I started working on Bleeding Hearts. I started gathering research and information and talking to activists and doing some traveling and just putting together what I see as the bigger picture of all these abuses that are happening. And then I just broke it down chapter by chapter and took breaks when I needed to. And I don't want to characterize the book as absolutely horrible. I mean, there are definitely atrocities in there that will trigger people, and I encourage people to just skip over those.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm a vegan. I've been a vegan for a long time, and I think it's so important that all of us eat plants and get to that place one way or another. But when we know that we don't need to eat animals to survive, it opens a whole door. And if we weren't eating animals, I don't think any of these other things would be going on. But we accept all of this exploitation because we say we need to eat these animals, we say we need to wear these animals, and then we need to experiment on them, and we need to do all kinds of horrible things to them. And it's from reading in your book, it goes from bugs to giraffes and elephants, the big
and
the
whales.
Small.
Yeah.
Every animal, if someone can profit on it, they do something horrible.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, I address the fact that 3,000 silkworms are killed to produce 1 pound of silk, and all the way up to the whale slaughter that happens in the Southern Ocean Sanctuary every year. We'll see if it happens in the next season. The Japanese have been ordered by the UN not to engage in that any longer, but we'll see if they hold to that.
Well, the problem that I've had with the whole whale issue and the dolphin issue is that when people from the United States tell Japan what to do, we're being hypocrites because we do horrible things in this country with animals. So it's a difficult argument for us to point fingers and say you shouldn't be doing this because look at what we're doing over here.
It is. And I should point out that it was the International Court of Justice in Europe that handed down that ruling.
Mm-hmm.
But you're absolutely right. We kill in this country, 9+ billion land animals a year for food. And we do all kinds of other atrocities, including, raising and killing animals for fur and using them for animal research and just many, many other abuses. So we really shouldn't be pointing fingers from a cultural standpoint. However, the Southern Ocean is an international sanctuary for these animals. And what Japan is doing is considered illegal. So I don't think that it's incorrect of the United States or Australia or New Zealand or other countries to be saying Japan shouldn't be down there doing that and we need to do something about it. And as activists, we need to speak up.
Okay, let's just touch on a few different things in this book, and I really recommend people reading it. It's very dense. There's a lot of information in here, and it's just unbelievable. But let's just talk about a few things that are unbelievable. So people like their dogs and cats, and a lot of people have companion animals, and they say they're animal lovers, and they don't realize what's behind the pet food that they're giving their animals.
Right. There's a couple things with pet food. One is that the major pet food companies actually test on animals, and they'll keep them in confinement, many of them for the rest of their lives, in cages, and they test the food. But beyond that, there's also something called 4D meat, which is meat that's been essentially not slated for human consumption because of disease or some other reason. It's not considered clean for human use, and so they feed it to it gets rendered and it goes through a giant processing system where sometimes even flea collars go through that because these animals have been found, sometimes they're even companion animals, found on the road. And it's turned into like a slurry, and it ends up eventually finding its way as an ingredient into all kinds of animal feed, not just what we consider companion animal food, but also for the agriculture, for farmed animals.
It's recycling.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's cost-effective.
It's completely legal, and it's been done for decades, and very few people know about it.
Well, we hear more about cows and pigs and chickens. Not enough, in my opinion, but we do talk about food animals, and there have been some undercover clips that have gotten out, and people are a little bit more aware of them. But there are so many animals out there. I mean, where do we begin? So the seals in Canada have been getting some press.
Yeah, the seal slaughter is going on right now in Canada. And, the two major seal slaughters take place in Canada and in Africa, in Namibia. And the one in Canada going on right now it's really hubris, I think. I think the Canadian government is doing it because they don't want to be told, as we kind of touched on at the
mm-hmm.
beginning of our conversation, they don't want to be told what to do.
Mm-hmm.
And there's really very little market for it. The EU has declared that there's a ban on seal products in Europe, and so Canada has been looking toward China and other countries to find a place for these products. And
now, it's just horrific what's done, but what is so profound to me is that these animals go to a place where they feel they can be safe to bear their children, and they're not safe at all.
Mm-hmm.
And when are they going to learn that? And if they do learn it, where would they go?
Yeah, it's really tragic because, as you say, this is where these seals give birth. I mean, this is a nursery for these animals, and we're losing pieces of our environment constantly because of climate change, and unfortunately, the ice is one of those victims, and yeah, the seals are losing habitat constantly, and it's just such a tragedy to see these things. And that actually, one of the things I talk about in my activism is how activists need to protect themselves from certain images if it triggers them. And when I first got involved in activism, it was the images of these sealers on the ice beating to death these seals that triggered for me just the most horrible nightmares and thoughts. So that's one of the things that I have to keep my distance from. And when I was writing that section, of course, I had to really step back and be careful about how I was characterizing it, how I was describing it, because I want it to be accurate, but I also don't want people to be so put off by it that they don't take it in and want to do something about it.
There's a lot of detail in this book. You talk about the skinning of different animals and how many of them are still alive when it happens, dogs even.
Yeah.
It's just, and I know this. I've read these things before, but I think it's important to read them again from time to time. It's just unbelievable. And personally, I like to focus on the joy behind plant food eating and all the delicious recipes and how good we look and how good we feel. I'm not sure if I'm just trying to protect myself from staying away from the reality. But it's good to check in every now and then and remind ourselves of how awful it really is.
It is awful, and I wanted to be careful when I wrote the book to include information on what people can do about it.
Right.
And so throughout the chapter, you find stories of activists and groups working to make change, and you also have each chapter ending with long sections about people you can contact, groups you can get involved with, ways you can personally help. So I want this to empower people like Striking at the Roots does. I want people to feel that they can have a voice, that they can make a change, that they can be agents of change, and not just feel helpless after reading the book.
One of the stories that I liked was about the woman who saw the bile bears.
Oh, right, Jill Robinson.
Yeah, and I think it's so important to look in the eyes of another being, whether it's a human animal or a non-human animal.
Yeah.
There's a connection. Can you just briefly tell that story?
Sure. Well, Jill Robinson was in Asia. She's actually from England, and she was living in China. And she happened to, she knew, she was an animal advocate, but she heard about the whole bear bile industry. And she decided to take a tour of one of these farms, and she kind of got away from the group at one point and went downstairs under one of these buildings, and she found just cage after cage of these moon bears, Asiatic black bears they're also called, in these just horrible conditions. In some cases, the flesh was growing into the bars because they had been in there so long. And each one of them had a tube into his or her abdomen, and it was basically milking their bile. And the bile is used in traditional Chinese medicine as a curative. And it comes from the gallbladder. And she heard this sound in the darkness, and she got closer and closer, and she realized that one of these bears was suffering. They all were suffering, but this is one who was sort of communicating, vocalizing to her. And Jill put out her hand, and she said this bear grasped, she felt this big paw around her hand, and she realized later that was probably not the smartest thing to do, because this bear had no idea who she was, and she could have been one of the people torturing her.
It knew. He knew. That bear knew.
And it just completely transformed Jill, and she dedicated her life to helping these bears, and she founded Animals Asia, and they do incredible work. They have two sanctuaries. They have one in China and they have one in Vietnam, and they just recently rescued 200 bears from one of these bear bile farms. The bear bile farm in China agreed to close, and they're turning that into another sanctuary for bears. And it's absolutely astounding, and it's stories like that that give me hope.
Yep.
And it's stories like that that I wanted to include in the book to share this information. And I was very, very thrilled that Jill participated and was willing to talk to me about her work.
We were talking earlier in the program with Anthony Nocella about his work and how he has spaces where people can come together and talk about animal studies and things related to animals in a safe, secure environment. Mm-hmm. And he just briefly mentioned, and I thought, oh, I want to talk about this later, but how in schools students have to do dissections and things if they're in some sort of medical or biological field. And you talked a bit about that, about how some students didn't want to do it and how many of them were made to do it. Their grades were threatened. Their performance in school was threatened, and it just took the courage of one in particular to make change. And I think there's been a lot of schools that have changed over time, but it takes a lot of courage to make change and speak out.
Right. Yeah. One story that comes to mind from the book is Jennifer Graham, who was a high school student in California, and she didn't want to dissect frogs, and she actually brought a lawsuit against the school board and won. And now it's thanks to Jennifer and brave students like her that high school students don't have to dissect animals in school. They can opt out. And that goes, it becomes more difficult as you get into college and certainly as you get into medical school. But there are changes being made. There are groups like Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine that are offering alternatives, that are working toward change, that are making it so schools have humane options, whether they're 3D models or some sort of advanced technology that don't involve animals, to just offering students ways that they can learn the information without having to conflict with their own morals, to contradict their values.
I guess one of the things that just kept hitting me in this book is it just seemed like so many products, almost every product has some cruelty involved in it. So you mentioned the process of making a pearl, something small and lovely and yet horrible.
Yeah, they inject a little irritant into the oyster so that the mm-hmm. animal puts a coating over this irritant eventually, and it becomes a pearl, and then they kill the animal and extract the pearl. And yeah, it's just astounding. And just for this little thing that you'll wear, which we have so many humane alternatives. There's things that are just as beautiful as a pearl that don't involve cruelty, at least not cruelty to humans and animals. And there's just no reason for it.
And then another point, you were talking about leather, and I know how many times I've heard some people will eat a vegan diet, but they wear leather because they feel the cows are being killed for food anyway. The leather's a byproduct, and they'll use it. And, everybody's got to make a choice what's right for them. But the leather industry, you explained, supports the food industry. They both make significant profit, and one can't do without the other.
Yeah, absolutely. They're really co-products. Leather is not a byproduct.
Mm-hmm.
They're co-products. They go hand in hand. I don't remember off the top of my head the figure, but it's something like $40 billion U.S. dollars a year in sales just from leather. And, it's as you say, people think that, oh, you kill a cow for her flesh, and then you take the skin, so it's not wasted. But, you know, there's really so many little products like calf skin, and, you know, that are specialty products that are obviously not byproducts. They couldn't be byproducts. They're part and parcel to the whole business of exploiting animals. They're considered resources, and they're harvested. And it seems like our goal is to squeeze the last penny out of an animal, and it's become standard practice.
Well, as I was reading, I kept thinking I didn't want to be a part of the human race.
Oh no. Karen, I don't want you to feel that way.
No. I step back and, you know, you start to see all the beauty and the hope. But it's just unfathomable what we're capable of. And yet I do believe in my core that every person is capable of transformation.
Absolutely. I wasn't born vegan. It took me, unfortunately, 30 years before I recognized what I was doing and decided that I didn't need to eat animals and that I didn't need to wear them. I didn't need to exploit them in the way that I was really
what,
a
what was
part
it,
of.
What was the epiphany for you? What was the veil lifting for you?
Well, I had a couple of events that occurred within a couple months of each other. That I was living in Europe at the time. This was in the 90s, and I decided I wanted to go to Pamplona and run with the bulls. And so I I was living in Germany. I took the train down to Pamplona, and I did the whole bull run. I thought it was, you know, this great Hemingway experience. And then at the end of the bull run, all the bulls go into the bull ring, and then all the tourists and the bull runners go in and sit on the stands. And hundreds and hundreds of people are in the bull ring taunting these steers. They're not the actual bulls who will fight, but they're these other animals that have smaller horns. And they're hitting them with newspapers, and they're just becoming, they're just ridiculing them. I don't know how else to describe it. And I just felt so ashamed to be part of this event. And a couple months later, I was living in India, and I was living with a Buddhist family in the Himalayas, and the only time that they would consume animals was when they would drink tea. They would drink what's called butter tea.
Hmm.
And it's this horrible salty thing that made me cry. And the only way I could even swallow it was if I thought of it as soup and not tea.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a couple of cows who lived across the road, I should say. And the other part of the story is that the family I lived with had this big garden. And I would say 99% of what I ate came from their garden. And as it got toward winter, they dug a big hole in the ground, and they harvested the crops, and they buried it for the winter. They buried the vegetables and fruits.
Mm.
And then they let one of the cows in from across the road to sort of nibble on the stems and the remaining crops. And I had never been so close to a cow in my life, notwithstanding my experience in Pamplona. And I was maybe 4 or 5 feet from this beautiful cow, and she just was looking at me, and I was looking at her, and I realized she has absolutely every right that I do in terms of living and enjoying her life. There's no reason I need to eat.
You looked in her eyes.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I just recognized the beauty in her and her will to live and enjoy her life and not be abused by humans. And so that's when I decided I had been living essentially a vegan life for 2 months already, and I felt physically and spiritually fantastic. And I thought, there's just no reason for me to continue this way. And so I stopped eating animals.
Well, Mark, I'm glad you had that experience, and I'm grateful for this book that you wrote, and everyone should read it. We need to know about all of this and then be inspired to do a lot about it, because there's a lot of work to be done.
Thank you. Can I mention my website?
Yes, yes, of course.
People can just go to markhawthorne.com, and they'll learn more about it. And I really appreciate being on your show, Karen.
Thank you. Take care.
Thanks so much.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Wow. Mark Hawthorne, Bleeding Hearts, The Hidden World of Animal Suffering. Thank you for listening, and read that book, okay? I'm Karen Hartglass, and this is another It's All About Food. Go to ResponsibleEatingAndLiving.com and watch that Lone Vegan trailer, please. Thank you, and have a delicious week.